Thank you. What a great time of worship together. Let's turn our Bibles to John chapter 12. And even as you're turning there, let me make just a couple of comments. I did not take the opportunity this morning, and I should have, to introduce my wife. My wife of 25 years, Sherry, is sitting over here on my right. She has been my biggest supporter and my most honest critic. And it's good to have both, isn't it? It's good to have someone that will encourage you in your walk with the Lord. I've had the joy of traveling to around 45 countries or so, and she's been with me to over half of those, travels with me on a yearly basis, a couple times to China. And so it's a vital, obviously, part of my life, the better half without question. Now, I also said she is my most honest critic. And in a good way, even on the way home tonight or this morning, she commented to me. She said, anytime you speak, I wait for the other shoe to fall. And the other shoe is you're normally sitting in the car, and we commented on the blessing it was to be here. And she said, the message this morning, you kind of ended abruptly. And she said, you gave us commands, but you didn't give us hope. And that it was true. It's honest evaluation. One of the things that we talked about this morning was the reality that we are to see people as Christ sees people, and there is a weight that comes with that. And at the same time, with that imperative, there also has to be an indicative. There also has to be a positional truth. There also has to be empowerment to allow that to take place. We know that Christ says that his yoke is easy and his burden is light. And at the same time, in stating that, he does not by any stretch of the imagination communicate that the Christian life is easy and weightless. What he communicates is that in that yoke that is placed upon us, that there is an empowerment that we have in the gospel through gospel grace that allows us to carry that weight and to fulfill those commands outside of our own wasted efforts. In essence, he empowers us to do it by the power of the cross. And really, through the course of both tonight and then I hope on Monday and on Tuesday, I want to focus not just merely on the imperatives of the mission, but I want to focus a little bit on the position that we have in Christ. Tonight, focusing really on the empowerment that we have in his death, and then the next couple of nights focusing on the empowerment that we have through dependence in prayer, and then ultimately our identity with Christ as it relates to, I'll use the phrase suffering. When we get to the passage, you realize it's much more than that. So that what we are called to do, we do not do in our own strength. Even when it comes to seeing people as Christ sees them, as broken and as bound, as blinded and as bruised, that's not something that we can manufacture within us. That is something that God allows us to do when our hearts are in tune with him on a daily basis. My task this evening is, it is difficult in that we have a lot of ground to cover, not necessarily by way of text. And let me give you a reading strategy or a listening strategy, probably more than anything as far as this evening is concerned. We're going to deal with one text, and that one text has one principle. Some sermons, as you know, have 3, 4, 5 points. I have one. Just one, and I'll probably say it 4 or 5 different times just for sake of repetition. Once we kind of walk through the text and establish that one point, we're going to illustrate that point in 3 different ways. We're going to illustrate it within the context of the passage, because the text has an agricultural nuance to it, and we're going to illustrate it within the history that is bound within the text, in essence what happens next. And then we're going to actually illustrate it from a contemporary, and I'll say contemporary, something that's happened within the last 100 years, that will be an extended illustration that I hope will, one, prompt a story that you're already familiar with. At least I trust that everyone is familiar with our concluding illustration. And if you're not, I hope that this morning will lay a foundation and perhaps prompt you for some further reading and some further research on this. Ultimately, my goal is that the singular principle within this passage would impact our hearts deep and long. That would be my goal. John chapter 12 is where we are. Let me begin our reading in verse 20. It says this, we're at the Passion Week. It says, now among those that went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, sir, we would see Jesus. And Philip went and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. Now I'll just pause for a moment here, and I'll simply say, anytime you see Andrew and Philip together, they're almost always bringing people to Jesus. That's just what they do. So the question is asked by this group of Greeks that are probably Jewish proselytes. They come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. They've heard of this individual by the name of Jesus, and they simply say, we want to see him. Now, here's the key. What we would anticipate so far in the narrative is that as these Greeks come to Andrew and Philip, and as they approach Christ, that ultimately the final episode within this narrative is that Christ is going to interact with these Greeks. They said, we would see Jesus, therefore we expect that to take place. But it doesn't. Christ's response, verse 23. And Jesus answered them, the hour has come that the Son of Man is to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loses his life, or whoever loves his life, loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for life eternal. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Wouldn't it be nice if we could actually just read through the entire Bible sometime as if it were the first time? And we would have the eyes of the original reader, and my guess is we'd be able to see things that we hadn't seen before. One of the things that we would see when we read through the Gospel of John is this concept of my hour has come. This is not the first time that Christ notes this hour. As a matter of fact, it's a continual hint and clue dropped all throughout the Gospel. John chapter 2, Christ speaks to his mother and says, my hour has not come. In John chapter 4, he says, my hour has not come. In John chapter 6, he says, my hour has not come. In John chapter 7, he says, my hour has not come. In John chapter 8, he says, my hour has not come. And if you're a reader of the Gospel of John, as you see this repetition of this theme in your heart, you're going to say, well, what hour are you talking about? What event is going to take place that you are looking forward to from the beginning of your public ministry? Thus, when we get to John 12 and Christ declares, my hour has come. Right, this is a climax within the gospel. This is Christ saying, slow down, take note. My hour has come. Really, one of the things that strikes me about this particular passage and one of the things that captivates me is the entire context. One, the context of the Greek question and the reality that he avoids their question. He avoids this divine appointment, seemingly, of seeing the Greeks. And he simply says, my hour has come. And thus his hour even supplants those that would seek to meet him. The other thing that strikes me about this particular passage is the stark contrast of his response. Our English text doesn't necessarily do it full justice because within verses 23, 24, and 25, what we have is we have two if-then statements. Right? It literally could be read, if a corn of wheat dies, and if a corn of wheat does not die, with two results. If a man loves his life, if a man hates his life. All right, so you have two stark contrasting statements. And bound within those two contrasting statements is really the secret of a fruitful life. Let's go back and focus specifically on verse 24. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. So in essence, what Christ is doing is he's giving the secret for a solitary life. He's giving the plan for a life that abides alone, that has no fruit, that will invest itself in the totality of hours and of days, but at the end of that life, it is meaningless. Right? That's the one life, the life of in essence, meaninglessness, the life that is solitary. Then on the other side, if a corn of wheat or if a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it brings forth much fruitfulness. So, trapped between a life that multiplies itself and a life that is in complete solitary confinement is this if-then statement. And at the center of the if-then statement is the concept of death. Now, this isn't not terribly difficult to understand. We see this all the time as it relates to agriculture. There's a simple principle in agriculture, and it's this, that for something to reproduce itself, it must die. Right? Let me put it another way. For there to be a fruitful life, there must be a selfless death. Right? We know that as it relates to agriculture. That's just a basic understanding. Right, let me just see if I can even illustrate this beyond that just for a moment. I have in my pocket some seeds here. Can I get your help just for a moment? Yeah, come on up here. All right, you don't have to necessarily be an agriculturalist. Those are seeds, correct?
Yes.
Do you know what kind of seeds those are?
I do not.
Those are actually apple seeds.
Okay.
That's the leftover from lunch today. Would you like them?
Sure.
Here you go. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. There's about seven of them there, right?
Yep.
Okay. I'll let you keep those.
Okay.
Or, see if I have any money. No credit cards. This is actually funny. I communicated this morning. I've been traveling abroad, and so I actually have money. How would you like 100?
I'd like that.
Okay. All right. Now, it's 100 rupees. Okay. But nonetheless, here you go. Here's 100. Matter of fact, you know what? You're a nice kid. I'll give you 200.
Thank you.
Not a problem. All right,
there's one more in there.
All right, I'll give you 5 Chinese yuan to throw in there, and 2 Filipino pesos, all right? You just got my entire Asian travel budget right there. All right, your choice, though. Matter of fact, you know what, that's way too many Sikhs. I'm going to take 4 of them back. Your choice. You can keep the 3 Sikhs, or you can keep the 200 rupees, 5 yuans, and 2 pesos.
I'll take the money.
Are you sure you want to do that? Okay. Not a problem. I'll take it. What's your name, by the way?
Parker.
Parker? Thanks, Parker. Take money. Have a seat. Now, Parker's going to go home and find the exchange rate and find out how he really did with that. All right, question for you. Did he make a good investment? Did he make a good investment? Now, again, some of you are going, tell me how much that really was. Right, just so you have a rough idea, that's roughly about $2.25. Okay, and so if you add it all together, that's about where he's at. So he exchanged $2.25 for 3 Cs. And the question is, did he do well with that? Now, again, some of you are going, well, he could make the exchange, go to the grocery store, buy apples. Think about intrinsic value. In intrinsic value, if I just take one of these little seeds, and again, I'm not an agriculturalist, but I'm told that within this little seed, there's an embryo. And the way that God made that little seed is there's actually a little pinprick of a hole somewhere in that outer shell. And that someone could take that little seed and they could bury that in the ground and water would penetrate that little pinprick of a hole. And when water interacts with that life force inside that embryo, what would happen is life would suddenly be spawned. And when life suddenly starts to explode, what would happen is that outer shell would be broken wide open. And from that little seed, there would eventually come a little apple tree, a little sapling. Through time, that little sapling would start to reproduce itself, and there'd be multiple more apples. Then what someone could do is they could take all of those apples, take all of those seeds, and they could bury those in the ground. And ultimately, from that one little seed, you not just have a simple sapling, you have multiple little saplings. And then those trees would reproduce, and through time, they would all have seeds, and all of those seeds could be put in the ground. And then you could go from a single sapling to an orchard, and then to multiple orchards. And I would dare say that through time, we could probably fill this auditorium not with notes of 100 rupees, but with notes of true $100, perhaps $1,000. Perhaps far more than that. Because the reality is that this little seed has intrinsic value. Matter of fact, it has untold wealth, but it also has untapped potential. For this little seed to actually be valuable, what this little seed must do, if I can humanize it for a moment, it has to be willing to be thrown to the ground. And when it is thrown to the ground, it has to be willing to be crushed. And when the seed is willing to be buried, and when the outer shell is willing to be crushed, then and only then would life come out of it. Until then, it just is a little seed that would abide alone. See, I could take this little seed and I could say, wow, this thing has value. And since it has value, I could protect it. I have a little vault at home. I could put it in that little vault and I could say, because of the value of this seed, I'm going to make sure that no harm ever comes to it. And of course, the reality is that 100 years from now, someone could open my little vault, could pull out that little seed, and could say, what in the world is that? It only has value when it is crushed, when it is broken, when it is put out into the fields. Then life takes place. Until then, it's just a little seed. That's in essence what Christ is saying in John chapter 12. He's saying, verily, verily, or truly, truly, I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it abides alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. Principle, for there to be a fruitful life, there has to be a selfless death. Now, obviously, what Christ is speaking of within the historic context is what he's about ready to do. The day in which he's speaking is probably about roughly the 14th of the month Nisan. That would be our March-April time frame. He's speaking at the time which we would be at today. It'd be at the time at Jerusalem where those seeds that had been planted are just starting to spring to life. Wouldn't surprise me at all, even as Christ made that statement, if he didn't use some arm gestures so that those that heard him would look around and they would recognize the reality of that which he is speaking of. Because suddenly flowers would start to be blossoming at that point in the spring within Jerusalem. And the point that he's speaking of is his own life. Because there's coming that point in days when Christ, as that little seed, is about ready to walk out the garden gate with a tree on his back, and he's to be planted outside of the Garden of Gethsemane on the hill of Golgotha. And many at that point in time are going to look upon his life, and they're going to say, what a waste. His life was so valuable. He should have protected it. Think for a moment that if Christ hadn't have gone to the cross, what could have happened? He could be alive today, healing the sick, feeding the poor. 2,000 years of truthful, compassionate teaching, modeling righteousness, healing, providing, protecting, all of those things Christ could have had if he merely would have protected himself, because his life was so valuable. But instead, what Christ did, he took that life and he allowed it to be cast into the ground. He allowed it to be crushed. He allowed it to be buried. And 3 days later, it sprung to life. And 50 days after that, at the Feast of First Fruits, 3,000 souls were ushered into the kingdom. And for the last 2,000 years, multiple millions of individuals don't merely have food, don't merely have physical healing, they have spiritual regeneration, the impartation of spiritual life to that which is spiritually dead. And why do we today have the joy of regeneration? Because Christ understood that for there to be a fruitful life, there had to be a selfless death. And we mark that fruit today. That's the illustration that Christ gives. Truly, truly, I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and die, it abides alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. Now, the application of the principle is actually found in the next verse. Principle in verse 24. Application in verse 25. Again, comparative statements. If then, whoever loves his life loses it. Let's look at it just individually here. In essence, what Christ is saying is that whoever loves, the word here communicates the idea of cherish, coddle, protects. Whoever loves his life, and what Christ is speaking of here is not just the physicality of life. What he's talking about is the essence of life. Right? What we consider our priorities, our resources. All of us have resources, both tangible and intangible. From a tangible perspective, we have liquid assets. We have money. We have property. From an intangible perspective, we have skills. We have talents. We have energy. We have time. Right? All of those things comprise what we define as life. And what Christ says is this, is the individual who protects those things, who coddles those things, right? That individual is the one who actually will lose his life. And it's a very strong word here, by the way. Has the idea of destroy his life. The individual who treasures his life, treasures his resources, treasures those things that are important to him, that individual, going back to our previous concept, is the individual who actually abides alone at the end of the day. They lose their life. They have nothing. Contrast to that is simply this. But whoever hates his life, whoever releases it, whoever allows themselves to be planted in the ground, whoever understands that their resources are to be utilized, not protected. Whoever does that, they lose their life. They hate their life in this world. That individual will keep it for life eternal. That individual will be the individual that reproduces themselves over and over and over and over and over again. So that the principle of agriculture, as demonstrated in the life of Christ, is the same principle that rings true in our lives today. And the principle is simply this: for there to be a fruitful life, there must be a selfless death. And what that death looks like is the releasing of all of those things which we hold near and dear to ourselves, and allowing those things to be cast into the field of ministry, buried there, so that God can use them to produce spiritual life in others. That's the difference between a life that is lived in solitary and a life that multiplies itself. Now, what does this look like? I'm a visual person. I like stories. And so we've illustrated it via the seed, and I think we all understand that. We've illustrated it via the life of Christ. Let me illustrate it just by way of missions. And the story is a familiar one. And it's one that has an overseas context to it, but I think the applications as we talk about local missions will become apparent. How do we invest our lives? How do we lose our lives? Well, there's one individual who's well known for the way that he has invested his life, and his name is Warren Buffett. Over the past 50 years, Warren Buffett has, without question, emerged as arguably the greatest investor in American history. If you had invested $10,000 in Berkshire Hathaway when he took control in 1964, your holdings today would be worth $60 million. Some of you who had $10,000 in 1964 are still scratching your head over that. Good investor, without question. But let's make some comparisons with those that would roughly be his contemporaries. Let's talk about a particular day, defined as D-Day on Palm Beach, January 8th, 1956. There's a series of individuals that chose to invest their life. Those individuals were involved in what they defined as Operation Aka. And the question we're going to ask this evening is simply this: was that a good investment or not? Was it a good investment? Let's just look at each one of the individuals that were involved, and it's purposeful in looking at them, even the details of their life. One of the individuals, and there were five men that were involved in Operation Aka, one of them was an individual by the name of Ed McCauley. Ed McCauley was born and raised in Milwaukee. His father actually worked in a bakery. He attended Wheaton College in Chicago. He was 6'2", 190 pounds, an absolutely outstanding athlete, played in three different sports. He majored in business and in economics. He was an outstanding, excellent speaker and student. He actually had represented his high school and his college on national debate teams and on national oratory teams, always finished in the final five. He was actually the senior class president when he was at Wheaton. Ed McCauley was, just in simple terms, was the ultimate big man on campus. Both from a physical perspective at 6'2", 190, but also from an intellectual and an academic perspective, and from a social perspective. Everyone wanted to be like Ed McCauley. He was just that kind of a guy. Ultimately, he went back to Milwaukee, attended law school at Marquette Law School, but in the midst of law school, he got married at 24, had two children over the next 3 years, and at 25, he left Marquette to join a friend by the name of Jim Elliott on this endeavor defined as Operation Aka. His wife was 8 months pregnant on what we've defined as D-Day, January 8th, 1956. What's interesting is Ed McCauley actually wrote out an investment plan. Let me just read it for you, and you can kind of follow. He wrote this on December 18th, 1955. That is weeks before D-Day. He said, as we weigh the future and seek the will of God, does it seem right that we should hazard our life for just a few savages? If God would grant us the vision, the word sacrifice would disappear from our lips and thoughts. We would hate the things that seem dear to us. Our lives would suddenly be too short. We would despise the time-robbing distraction and charge the enemy with all of the energies in the name of Christ. Wrote that within the context of his own personal diary, December 18th. So the second man that was involved in Operation Laka, and the second man was just almost completely the opposite of Ed McCauley. His name was Pete Fleming. Pete Fleming was born, raised in Seattle, accepted Christ at age 13, actually underneath the mentorship of a blind evangelist. He graduated at the top of his high school class, majored in philosophy at the University of Washington, earned a master's degree in literature. And then, at 24, he joined his friend Jim Elliott, going to Ecuador. 26, he married his childhood sweetheart, had two children over the next 2 years. If Ed McCauley was the big man on campus from an athletic perspective, Pete Fleming was like the geek in the brain. Right, he was the guy that focused on languages. I mean, who actually majors in philosophy and thinks that you're actually going to get a job that way? He did. He loved it. Followed it up with literature. His love was the study, the academy, books. But his heart was similar to McCauley's. Again, he wrote his own investment plan. He wrote this in August of 1951. He says, the Lord has been leading my meditation to the stringent statements of Christ regarding discipleship, especially those words of Christ to his disciples before he sent them out. He that findeth his life shall lose it. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. I have been directed to these and similar passages again and again. I should like to put these truths to the utmost test. Seemingly, God delights in many instances to place men in situations which magnify their weaknesses for the simple delight of showing himself strong to all observers. That's Pete Fleming. It's a third man. Third man was very different than the previous two. His name is Roger Udarian. Roger Udarian was actually born on a ranch in Sumatra, Montana. He's actually crippled with polio at age 9, attended Montana State College for 2 years, joined the Army in 1943, and was actually a paratrooper in the Battle of the Bulge. Ultimately came back from World War II, graduated from Northwestern with a degree in education, married at 27, and then had two children. He was the oldest of them all. At 29, he joined the team for Ecuador. Now, if McCauley was the big man on campus and Pete Fleming was the brain, Roger Udarian was the brawn. He was the brawn, but at the same time, he actually had a timid soul. Of all the individuals involved, he was the one that at times would question whether he should be there. He would question whether God could use him. But he was a man of perseverance, and actually one of his best friends, a man by the name of Nate Saint, consistently encouraged him to stay the course. Roger Udarian had an investment plan as far as his life was concerned, writing again December 19th, weeks before what we've defined as D-Day. He wrote this within his diary, I die to self. I will begin to ask God to put me in the service of constant circumstances where to live Christ, I must die to self. I will be alive unto God that I may learn to love him with all of my heart, mind, soul, and body. That's Roger Udarian. Now, I want to pause just for a moment here, and I want to note something for you. None of these men were missions majors. None of these men were Bible majors. None of these men were, quote unquote, called into ministry. This is an educator, a philosopher, and a businessman that the Lord used. Okay. There's a fourth man. Fourth man is one whose name we're perhaps more familiar with. His name's Nate Saint. Nate Saint was born in Philadelphia. His father worked in a glass factory. He was an avid pilot, learned to fly in high school, served in the Army Air Corps in World War II, but was forced to leave due to a leg injury, which was absolutely personally devastating to him. All Nate Saint ever wanted to do from the time he was young was to be a pilot. And with this injury, the Army would not allow him to fly. They turned him into a mechanic, and it just rent his heart. Time doesn't allow us, but it was actually in the city of Detroit on a New Year's Eve service that the Lord got a hold of his heart. Within his own diary, he says he can't remember what, it was at a service in downtown Detroit, he can't remember what the preacher ever spoke on, but he remembers walking out into the streets of Detroit, and it was snowing that evening, and he speaks in terms of the city, the sounds of the city being muffled. You know how it is when it's snowing, and even when you're downtown, everything is muffled. And in the midst of that, he said he did not hear the audible voice of God, but it was as if the Lord was asking him, Nate, are you willing to sacrifice all my way, not your way? Nate Saint records in his diary that at that point he felt the same joy that he had at the day of his salvation in releasing everything to the Lord at that point. Nate Saint had an investment plan. He simply wrote this. And people who do not know the Lord ask, why in the world will we waste our lives as missionaries? They forget that they too are expending their lives, and when the bubble has burst, they will have nothing of eternal significance to show for all the years that they have wasted. Then obviously there's a fifth man, and the fifth man is a man by the name of Jim Elliot. Jim Elliot was born in Portland, Oregon, in a pastor's home, accepted Christ at age 6. He was an outspoken Christian in high school, majored in Greek at Wheaton, and actually protested that the need to take general education classes due to their silliness. At the end of his first semester, he actually failed history and English. He had the ability, he just thought they were silly. He wanted to be in ministry and ministry alone. It was actually after a long conversation with his father, who was paying his school bill, that prompted him to go back and to give himself perhaps a little bit more seriously to the other aspects of his studies. He went back to Wheaton, graduated, journaled extensively, and that's why we know Jim Elliot. From the time he was in high school, he started writing down that which the Lord was prompting his mind by way of personal growth. Those journals are available today. Eventually married a woman by the name of Elizabeth at age 26, and they had one daughter. Within his journal, Elliot communicates his investment plan. He simply says this, "We are so utterly ordinary, so commonplace. While we profess to know a power the 20th century does not reckon with, but we are harmless and therefore unharmed. We are spiritual pacifists, non-militants, conscientious objectors in this battle to the death with principalities and powers in high places. Meekness must be had in contact with men, but brass, outspoken boldness is required to take part in the comradeship of the cross. We are sideliners, coaching and criticizing the real wrestlers, while content to sit by and leave the enemies of God unchallenged. The world cannot hate us. We are too much like its own. Oh, that God would make us dangerous." He was 23 when he wrote that. These five men the Lord brought together. Their task was to reach a group of Akan Indians in the jungles of Ecuador. To do so, ultimately, they flew around the camp several times, did as much survey work as they possibly could, ultimately found a spit of land on the Curray River, and established what they defined as Palm Beach. They did that on January 3rd. On January 4th, they continued to fly around the Akan camps. What they would do is Nate Saint had actually learned how to fly the plane in such a way that it would go in circles, and he would drop a bucket out of that plane and would put things in the bucket. And that bucket would stay stationary enough that the Indians would gather around and would pull things out of the bucket, and then they would replace it with gifts of their own that would then be pulled into the plane. Among those gifts, they gave axes, they gave books, they gave various things to the Indians, and the Indians responded by actually giving a parakeet. And they became a pet as far as the family was concerned. And that was the relationship that was developed even prior to these 2 days. But these 2 days of January 4th and 5th were really spent cementing that relationship. Ultimately, their joys were fulfilled on January 6th when three Aucans actually emerged from the jungles, came to Palm Beach, and sat there, and as much as possible, they had a conversation. One of those Indians walked over to the plane and began to flap his arms, opened the door, wanted a ride in the plane, and so Nate Saint actually took him aloft. And Nate Saint tells the story of, as that plane is going around, this Aucan Indian has his arms outside the windows, and he's flapping his arms. And Nate couldn't tell whether he was just waving to the people down below or if he was trying to keep the plane aloft. All in all, the afternoon of January 6th was a successful afternoon. Matter of fact, those men went to bed with one of the Aucans still there, sitting by the campfire. What they anticipated was that this initial contact would lead to further contact for the sake of the gospel. On January 7th, no Aucans came. They flew up over the village, and no Aucans were in the village. They seemingly had just disappeared. Finally, on January 8th, which was a Sunday, they knew a storm was rolling in, so they contacted their wives at 12:30. And what they told their wives was simply this. They said, if no Aucans come out by 4:30, that will be our last opportunity to depart. They planned on boarding the plane and then going back and joining their wives and trying again later in the month. 4:30 came around, and there was no contact that was made between these five men and their wives. The evening progressed. No contact. Dark settled in. They realized at that point in time that no contact would be made. Their wives contacted, in essence, the Civil Air Patrol, who then flew over that camp the next day. But the fog had settled in, and really nothing could be seen. And so on Monday, there was no knowledge of what had taken place. On Tuesday, a wind blew in, and the fog began to part. And as the planes were in search of those men, they flew over Palm Beach, and they saw the plane. They saw metal. They realized that the plane was no longer in a single piece, but had been spread across the beach. It actually took several more hours before a plane landed at that location. And many of you know what they found. The reality is that at 3:30, those men were ushered into eternity. Matter of fact, specifically at 3:12, Nate Saint's watch had stopped. Those five men were murdered by 10 Aucans. Five came out of the jungle. Five came from across the river. They speared them. They stabbed them. They slaughtered them. They had guns. Two of the men did. But they refused to shoot an Aucan. They shot two warning shots in the air, but nothing else. All five men, their lives were lost. What a waste, huh? Five talented men, five men with families, five men with a bright future. So the question is simply this: did their investment plan ever pay off? Well, providentially, there was a journalist that was there who was actually an unsaved individual from Life magazine. And when he heard of the story, he got on one of those planes and went to Palm Beach and began taking pictures that were there. And ultimately, he wrote an article in Life magazine. Came out January 30th, and the headline was simply this: "Go ye and preach the gospel, five do and die." What that author did not intend was for others to follow. But what happened is that Life magazine set a blaze in the hearts of young people who had a heart for God. And in place of those five that died, hundreds stood up and said, "Here am I, Lord. Send me." Ultimately, as far as the Aukins were concerned, 2 years later, Rachel Saint and Betty Elliott moved back into the Aukin village. Kathy and Steve Saint were actually baptized at Palm Beach by an Aukin, the one who murdered their father. And within years, 9 years later, the first copies of the Gospel of Mark were translated into the language of the Aukins. And Kimu, one of the individuals that was involved in the murder, stated the following. He said, "Father God, you are alive. This is your day, and all of us have come to worship you. They brought us copies of your carving, enough for everyone. We accept it, saying, this is the truth, but we want all of your carvings." Today, the Aukins are still vibrant testimonies for Jesus Christ within Ecuador. In the lives of Nate Saint, Jim Elliott, Roger Udarian, Pete Fleming, they still reverberate today as seeds that have been cast into the ground and crushed. But life comes forth. They understood a simple principle. Principle was that, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, except a grain of wheat fall to the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life will lose it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it into life eternal." And so the simple question is this: who do you think made the better investment? I don't know the spiritual condition of Warren Buffett, and so I won't speak to that. But I know who I'd rather be when standing before the Father. The man who understood that he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Now, what does that have to do with us today? We're talking about local missions. The principle is still the same. You are being called this week to take your life, your talents, your time, your money, your tangible and intangible resources, and to take them and to cast them into the field of ministry. It will cost you. Probably not to the extent of these five men. But you must be willing to die to something if you're going to give life to anything. So the question that the passage motivates us to ask this evening is simply this: what must you die to for these ministries to be able to give life? For there to be a fruitful life, there must be a selfless death. You must die so they can live. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for the patience of these folks. And we will simply ask that the simple principle of John 12 would resonate within our lives this evening until the day of our death. And we'll give you thanks in your name.